Chewie, we're home.
I bypassed the compressor.
You were the chosen one!
Something truly special.
Congratulations, you are being rescued.
Revenge is not the Jedi way.
I am no Jedi.
The ability to speak might not make you intelligent, but we're going to try to prove otherwise. This is the Clashing Sabers podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brandon, and I'm here with my co-host tonight, the man who has the mind of Ki-Adi Mundu and the body of Opal Rancisis. It's
Devore.
How are you doing tonight, Devore?
Doing good. How about yourself?
I'm doing quite well. I'm on spring break, so, you know, I'm going to enjoy the week off. The school environment around spring break time kind of feels like Jeddah right around when Cassian and Jin get there, and they're like, this place is about to blow. So it's going to be nice to have a little break, and particularly to do this episode tonight because we are bringing back Best and Butts, talking about Best and Butts Force users. So it's going to be a lot of fun to do that, and we not only don't know what's on each other's list, we don't even know how we quantified or qualified who is going to make it onto our list. So we are in for some kind of adventure. It might be a train wreck, but it'll definitely be interesting. So going to be a lot of fun to do that tonight. Before we get into that, though, please, if you're listening, make sure you are subscribed so you can get all of our shows right here in your feed each week. We were working on some Sith Talk stuff today. Of course, we're coming out with the Clashing Sabers podcast. A new Star Wars book is out, so there'll be a new Don't Burn the Sacred Text here in the near future. So if you dig what we're doing here, make sure you're subscribed, and we would love and appreciate it if you could go over wherever you're listening and leave us a rating and review so we can show up on the charts and really to continue helping us with our main mission of putting Star Wars books into classrooms across the country. So if you want more information on that, make sure you head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/clashingsabers. So now that all that housekeeping's done, speaking of new books, Devore, I got a new book. And it is not a book that you might think that I got.
Okay, go on.
This book is from Chronicle Books. They contacted us and offered to send a couple copies. And it's by author Kelly Knox, and it is Star Wars Dad Jokes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I thought we would do a little segment on here where we would do some of these dad jokes because they're actually quite good. I haven't worked my way through the whole book, but they're a lot of fun. So you ready for some of these?
All right, let's do it.
All right. Did you hear the one about the stormtrooper who couldn't see out of his helmet?
No.
Yeah, he didn't know what he was missing. That's a good one. That's the first one in the book. I'm starting on page one.
That's a good one.
What happens when Imperial fighters race each other? Do you know?
I don't.
Well, it always ends in a tie. It's great. I love it. Speaking of, we were talking about Rogue One earlier. How many rebels does it take to transmit the stolen Death Star plans?
I don't know. How many?
One and or two. Guys, this book is great. Shout out to Kelly Knox. Get a copy of this. How does Darth Vader keep his Star Destroyer warm?
I don't know.
With a space heater. So we're gonna have to go through some of these. Here's a good one. Where does Palpatine keep his Sith armies?
I don't know.
In his sleeveys. Personally, I would have written in his sheevies, but you know. That's just the kind of terrible person that I am. So go check out, if you haven't gotten it already, it is The Best Worst Jokes and Puns from a Galaxy Far, Far Away from Chronicle Books. It's a nice little compact size if you're going to the beach or something over the spring break vacation. I almost said summer vacation. That's where I'm at in this year. You can definitely do that. So I think we're going to share some more because I want to hear Drew's reaction to some of these that are in this book.
Oh, and, yeah. He would love this.
Yeah, and he's not able to join us tonight. He is he's with the medical droid healing up, so he'll be back on hopefully on the next episode. But you know, we talked to him last time about things that he had been Star Warsing. I know you and I have been Star Warsing The Bad Batch. We touched briefly on that, and we're going to cover that more as we get to the end of the season and do our best in butts format there, reviewing the season as a whole. Other than Bad Batch, man, what have you been Star Warsing lately?
So not that long ago, I finished what is a bona fide Star Wars classic for the first time. That's right, friends. I read Heir to the Empire.
First time?
First time.
Okay, when we say Heir to the Empire, because there's two ways that people talk about it. Are we talking about the book Heir to the Empire or the trilogy?
The book.
Okay, okay.
Installment number one.
And?
It was aggressively fine.
Oh, man, that is accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. As someone, I mean, I know you and I relate on this, who does not much care about Thrawn, I kept the ceiling pretty low, and it pretty much hit that low ceiling.
Here's the thing, too. In my opinion, the books do not get better as they go.
Ugh.
So.
Don't say that.
Like, the first book, I genuinely enjoyed. The second book, what is it, Dark Force Rising, I think is the name of it.
Yeah.
That would be one that I would qualify as aggressively fine. And then The Last Command is, it really just kind of set Legends in a place of like, we're going more sci-fi than we are space opera and fantasy. And I don't know that I love it. So.
Right.
But. Did any particular moments like stand out to you where you were like either really rolling your eyes or you had a light bulb go off or anything like that?
Oh, I'm going to talk about the eye roll moment, the moment where I was like, we can't be doing this. And it is the moment, it's early on in the book. It's when Thrawn and Pellion are, they go to Wayland and, you know, they find the Jedi Master and Thrawn looks to Pallian or whatever, and he says, that's not Joris Sabaoth. He pronounces his name Joris Sabaoth. He's a clone. You figure out he's a clone because he has an extra vowel in his name?
Oh, like, just wait
If I were not listening to the book, that would have been the moment I threw the book. What are we doing here? Are you kidding?
Just wait. Just wait until you get to The Last Command and keep... When you start that book, just keep in mind the extra vowel. All I'm going to say, if you know, you know.
Imagine if, quote-unquote, Disney Star Wars did that.
Oh, there would be riots outside of Lucasfilm.
Like, what? He has an extra vowel in his name. He's a clone. What?
Yeah, Fives is now spelled F-I-I-V-E-S.
Yes, he says his name's Fives.
What? My God. Yeah, yeah. Look, hey, like, I think, in my opinion, every Star Wars fan, at least those of us who are into the books, should read those books because of the historical significance of them. But I really struggle when reading old Legends books and comparing it to the quality that we've gotten in the majority of the new canon. Now, we've gotten some dumpster fires in the new canon. Don't get me wrong. I'm aggressively not a fan of the original Battlefront book, I think is the worst book in canon. I really don't like Last Shot. But, you know, there's just a lot in Legends where you just really wonder... if George had played more role in those books, would it have gone that direction? And I don't think George Lucas is like the be all end all of the great, you know, he can do no wrongs.
Right.
But he definitely, you know, was very hands off with where Legends went and didn't really consider it canon. And so they got to kind of just do whatever they wanted. And sometimes you got stuff like Plagueis and sometimes you get stuff like The Last Command. So... There's a lot of that. I actually am thinking over, I'm reading Resistance Reborn right now. Obviously, we've got the new High Republic book coming out. I want to go visit Courtship of Princess Leia. Have you read that
one? Oh, nice. I have not yet, no.
Okay. So, you know, Drew brought it up and said it was good. Amanda said she liked it well enough. And I've usually heard that it's just garbage. So I don't know. I kind of want to explore it myself and see there. You're going to have to report back on the rest of Heir to the Empire. And I want to hear what your reactions are to them.
Oh, I shall. Don't worry.
I am revisiting a much better book still, Resistance Reborn. And, you know, sometimes you just have like life synergy just all coming together.
Yeah.
This week's Bad Batch, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but the idea of regret came up a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I really, like, I know they didn't mean to make these two stories connect together, but Resistance Reborn is really dealing with Poe and a lot of his regret around the things that happened in The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And it's just, that to me is peak Star Wars storytelling, when these stories connect even though they don't mean to across like different themes. I don't really have a point to what I'm saying other than it was really cool that it happened and I really liked it, and it was really eye-opening of something I think that a direction that Disney Star Wars has pushed of going towards more of the how do we handle our traumas? How do we handle those dark moments in our lives? What do we do on the path to recovery from those hard times? Whether we, like Crosshair, were just very lost and didn't understand what was going on around us, or we were like Poe and we were arrogant. Either of those directions, you end up in the same place, and what do you do about them? And I don't know. It's just a beautiful thing, and I really like the direction that they have taken Star Wars to deal with less of that sci-fi kind of stuff that we got in Legends. And I'm not trying to crap on Legends. Like, if you love Legends, please love Legends. Like, your Star Wars is your Star Wars. Just don't be a dick about it. But I prefer the direction they've taken it of dealing with more of the PTSD, the traumas that we've all gone through, and especially with where our world is today and the, you know, COVID and the universal trauma that we've all gone through that, it's been nice to really feel that emotional connection that Star Wars really brings out.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, you know, you talking about that book, which is a great, if anyone listening has not read that book, go read that book. It's really, really good. I read it for the first time last year and had a great time with it. But I mean, just talking about that book and, you know, you were bringing up the connections with some of the stories in Bad Batch that we're getting right now with season three. That moment in the book, I think it's kind of towards the back end of the book where they're all meeting and Zay has the quote about a choice to be better. Like, that got me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every now and then that'll just pop up on my, that moment with Luke will just pop up on my Instagram or my TikTok or something. And I'm just like, I got to watch it. I can't not
it's
watch
so good.
This moment. It's so good. And I just, there definitely was, you know, synergy across Star Wars previously. You know, you had characters crossing over to different things, but they've just taken it to a whole nother level of really rewarding people who are invested in everything and not punishing people who aren't invested in everything, which was, I mean, I know I speak for a lot of people who got into the books with the Disney purchase. We just felt overwhelmed with how many stories there were that we would have to read in order to really get into the books of the Legends canon. And so I really appreciate that they are creating a space where they're telling these stories, and you can just watch Bad Batch and be totally fine. You could just read Resistance Reborn and be totally fine. But if you read these other things or you watch these other things, you get that added benefit to it that just makes the story so much more impactful. It's just, to me, it's really cool, creative storytelling when you're telling stories in this space where world building is such an important part. That's what George really did with A New Hope. Like, A New Hope's a very simple story. The world building, though, is insane.
Yeah.
And it just continues in. Empire takes it to another level. Return of the Jedi continues it on. And the prequels, I mean, are when you're talking about world building, the prequels take the cake, in my opinion. It's just insane how much they do. So it's cool to see it all come together, and even to see things like Thrawn crossover, you know? Like, I enjoyed Thrawn in the Ahsoka series. I know not everybody did, but I enjoyed that version of Thrawn. And I can't say that I've enjoyed a lot of Thrawn in the book. So it's cool to just get it in different formats. And I would say if you haven't checked something out, it's always worth checking it out. If you don't like it, you don't like it. If you do, you might end up finding something that's really special to your Star Wars journey. So anyways, that's my Star Wars emotional soapbox. So there you go. You're welcome. Do you want to go ahead and get into this? Because I feel like we've got some good stuff to talk about tonight.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we're going to be doing our best and butts for Force users overall in Star Wars. And for those of you who are listening for the first time or haven't listened to one of our best and butts episodes before, the way this works, our butts are things that we don't like, think could be improved, don't think are the highest quality, however you want to qualify a bottom style list. And then of course our best is our stuff that we like or is really good. And so tonight we're going to be talking about Force users, and it's not necessarily going to be a list of characters we like and characters we don't like. We left it up to each other to quantify and qualify what's going to be on our list. So Devor, when you were putting your list together, How did you figure it out? What were your parameters you put in place to figure out who was the best and butts of Force users?
Yeah. So when we were originally batting this idea around, you know, in our group chat, originally we kind of split it up. We were thinking about doing only the lightsiders or only the darksiders. And then we kind of decided to combine it and make it general Force users. So one, in the spirit of that kind of original way we were thinking about it, I decided for each of my best and my butts to do one lightsider and one darksider, just to get that representation there, you know, for both aspects of the Force that we get in Star Wars. For my bests, I thought about characters that I thought really kind of embodied the spirit or, you know, the ethos of, you know, each respective dimension of the Force. And for the butts, I really just pick people I like to dunk on. I just like to make fun of them. And so that was pretty much the only criteria. So the butts were actually very easy in that respect.
So Coleman Trabor is going to be both of your characters on your butts list.
What about you, Brandon?
I kind of tried to find this balance between how effective the characters are at accomplishing what they're trying to accomplish within the story, mm-hmm. their effectiveness as part of the story they are used for telling, so externally outside of the universe, and their ability to convey themes of Star Wars, how adept they are at the Force, and honestly, just their overall draw. Do they pull you to the screen or to the page, wherever their story is being told? And is surprising nobody. My best was actually quite easy to come up with. My butts were actually a lot easier than I was expecting because I'm a big Force user guy and I've got a lot mm-hmm. of Force users that I love. But this is not, for me, I was very careful. This is not a list of characters that I love or hate. And it's also not a power rankings. This is not me saying these are the most skilled Force users who are the strongest, because I hate that. I hate when people are like, oh, who's the more powerful one?
Me too.
That's not what the Force is about.
No.
And so that played, the way that characters handle the Force also played a role in that. So before we get into the butts, do you have any like honorable mentions on your butts that you want to dunk on real quick? Because I already kind of mentioned mine, which is Coleman Trabor. He just sucks. He just like jumps up there and then gets shot down. And I just think he deserves to be somewhere mentioned, that he is a very ineffective Jedi and doesn't really do anything at all.
Yeah, so I will give one of my bubble picks that, because we had talked about this of doing it like three each and then we shrunk it to two. So this one kind of bumped out, but I'm going to give my bubble pick for the butts of Ol Morok from Ahsoka, the TV show, who is there and is, you know, has some potential and he looks real cool and then just quite literally goes up in smoke.
Yeah, he does. He just farts out like a vacuum.
Yep.
It's not great. All right, well, let's go ahead and get into the proper list. And since you're on a roll already, I will let you go first with your butt number two.
All right, my butt number two. You know, Jedi, or at least, you know, one of the Jedi virtues is, you know, humility. There's not a lot of brownie points you get for being, you know, overconfident or arrogant or anything like that. And yet, there was one Jedi who really thought that he got this, only to be very quickly proven that he not got this. That's right. It is Jedi Master Colman Trabor.
You are kidding me.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, man, you held back really well on that
I one. Did, and that was hard.
I believe it.
Yes. So right here, I have to shout out Jared Boffman Stubbs, who podcasts over at Nerd Academy, who refers to Colman Trabor as the Force's favorite idiot. And for a couple of reasons. So one is his species is a Vork. And one of their features of that species is they have 360 degree eyesight. And the other thing about him is, admittedly, I think this is a Legends detail rather than canon, is that in Legends, he was a master of the lightsaber form Sarisu, which is a defensive lightsaber stance that was developed to protect against, that's right, blaster fire. So for being a species who can see literally everything around him and also being a master of a blaster defensive style and still getting taken out by old Jango Fett, Colman Trabor, my number two butt.
Yeah. Yeah, it's rough, man. I mean, he jumps up there and he's all confident and the Jedi are rolling and he's kind of one of the first to fall before, you know, you get he is the K2SO of the Geonosis arena, you know, like once he goes down, you go, oh, this isn't going to end well for anybody. And then Jango makes it worse because he does the little, you know, spins his gun and puts it in and everything. And it's like, come on, man, you've already dunked on the guy once. You don't need to make it worse. Like, that's salt in the wound right now. And homeboy just dropped like 50 feet off of the ledge. And he has literal, he can see 360 degrees, which means he has literal eyes in the back of his head. So, yes. Yeah, he is. The fact that, though, that he is so fleshed out as a character is just the most Star Wars thing ever. Yes. Like, every other franchise would be like, yeah, he jumped up there and then he died. And they're like, no, he has 360 degree visions. Yes. Here's his lightsaber form. It was, it's great. It's great. So my butts list ended up being all Darksiders, but purely by circumstance. I kind of went with gut instinct on this one. And the first one that popped into my head that I knew had to be on my list is a character that is I don't speak about a lot, but has bothered me for a long time. And that's Savage Opress.
I had a feeling someone was going to put Savage on tonight.
Yeah. See, he doesn't do anything special. And I don't really feel like he adds anything to the story. He's clearly a plot element to get Maul back into the story. That's fine. Mm-hmm. And he worked for that. But then it feels like they didn't know what to do with him. So he's not very effective in storytelling outside of we need to get to Maul somehow, which could have been him. It could have been a lot of other things. So it's not that he necessarily needed to exist for that to happen. I don't feel like he conveys any special themes about the Force or the nature of the dark side. And anything I think you could argue that he does has already been wrought by Maul himself. So there's not much there. He's this blunt force instrument. And it's just when you've got so many compelling Darksiders in the story, it makes him honestly kind of dull. I think to some extent they were trying to make him a testament to how the dark side manipulates between how he was used by Mother Talzin, how he was used by Dooku, and even to an extent how he was used by Maul. But you're really having to stretch to get that. And at best, it falls flat. So there's no story, and this goes to, you know, does he draw me to the screen? There's no story with Savage that I'm like, oh, I have to watch this because Savage Opress is in it. Like, you're watching it because Maul is in it, or Maul and Obi-Wan. You're not watching any of those Clone Wars episodes for Savage. He really feels like He feels like when like a big time pro wrestler like leaves and they try to get somebody who looks exactly the same to replace him and just pretend like people are not going to notice, or like a soap opera when they just replace out the characters. But the original character is still there. Like Maul is still there. So what is the point of Savage Opress? So, yeah, never been a huge fan. And I mean, if we want to talk about characters that didn't really get any training, he gets like 35 seconds of training and then he's like this insanely powerful force user. It doesn't fly for me. So, yeah, not a big Savage Opress guy.
All right. Yeah, like I said, I thought someone was going to bring him up tonight because he usually, you know, he is kind of low-hanging fruit in that respect. I think the one thing that does work for me with him, and again, I don't know if this was intended by, you know, the Clone Wars team for it to work exactly this way, or that this was the reason that he was put in the show, but I think he does sort of work in tandem with Maul's story in the sense of, like, the big kind of overarching thing with Maul's sort of post Phantom Menace return and his arc in the Clone Wars, and then ultimately when he pops up in Rebels, is this idea of someone who, you know, goes through this, through the dark side, and he's trained as a Sith apprentice, and then he's kind of cast aside, and rather than being able to kind of move on and let go, he's still kind of, you know, perpetuating that cycle. And so I think Savage kind of works in that way, in the sense of, like, he is literally another Maul, in the sense of, like, Maul is doing to Savage what was done to him by Sidious. And so I think it works that way in terms of illustrating that aspect of Maul's character, that he is just kind of continuing the cycle rather than breaking it. But other than that, yeah, there's not much value add to him as, you know, just by himself, sort of like you said, is like you see him there, like he's there with Maul, and really the reason you're there is for Maul.
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying about, you know, Maul perpetuating the cycle, but couldn't you have done that with, like, Ventress, you know?
Yeah.
Or some, you know, like you had other characters, you could have developed other characters to build to that Maul moment, and then you have an emotional attachment to these characters, and then it really hurts more, you know, like we're invested in Ventress. So if you have Ventress going off to find Maul to try to find some power that she thinks will let her get revenge on Dooku, then you've got a whole different story that you're telling, and you're emotionally invested in Asajj. Whereas when you get Savage, you know he's a carbon copy of Maul that's just leading to Maul. It's like the ghost of Maul going to search for himself.
Yeah. And
it just, yeah. It doesn't work for me. Like, I think they had an idea of what he would be, and I just don't think they executed it very well. And so that's why he makes mine. What about you? What else you got on your butts list?
My butts. So I did my light cider butt. Now I'm going to do my dark cider butt. I already talked about Marok as my bubble pick. And now I'm going to talk about another Inquisitor, the character who I have for some time referred to as the red shirt of the Inquisitorius. Let's talk about the Eighth Brother. We are introduced to him in Twilight of the Apprentice at the end of season 2 of Rebels. He is sent after Maul, he's trying to chase down Maul, and he's sort of just there and gone in this little arc. And much like with Coleman Trabor, he has the common attribute of him of really failing kind of despite himself. So the Eighth Brother, you know, he is, of course, armored the entire time that we see him, so we never actually get to see what he looks like. But if you look up his, you know, look him up on the Wook and stuff, the Eighth Brother is a Trellian Jango jumper. So this is a species that we first see in the Clone Wars. I think this is a season 1 or season 2 arc. It's one of those Coruscant arcs. They are the aliens who are, like, very athletic and can, like, jump between buildings. I think there's, like, a female bounty hunter that we get in one of those arcs.
It's who is season that 2 species? Or 3. They steal Ahsoka's lightsaber. Yeah.
Yes. It's that one. It's the lightsaber lost episode. Yeah. It's that exactly. So he is the member of the same species as them. And how does he die? He dies by falling from a great height because his lightsaber is broken and he tries to fly away. So once again, much like Coleman Trabor, who's got all these skills with defense against blasters and can see 360 degrees and is still shot dead, you are telling me that a species known for their acrobatics, a member of such a species, dies from falling? Eighth brother, you're on the top of my buds list.
Well, he didn't have a net underneath, and the acrobats are used to having a net underneath to make sure. So he got a little ballsy. Yeah, it's funny how, you know, we chose two characters that have to have a connection with Maul. I've never really seen the purpose of the eighth brother. Like, I guess to some extent he's supposed to show, you know, that there are more Inquisitors out there, but we kind of already got that with the other two Inquisitors we have in that season. Like, originally we thought the Grand Inquisitor was the only one, and then we learned there's more, and I don't think anybody at that point went, oh, well, these must be the only two other ones, because why wouldn't, like, we kind of got the gist that there were more Inquisitors out there, and they haven't really done anything with him in any other stories, you know? Like, it would be different. Like, imagine if it was, instead of Mark, it was the eighth brother that came back in Ahsoka, and you realize, like, he wasn't actually dead, and he was wanting revenge because Ahsoka was a part of that whole situation, and that was the only one he felt like he could get revenge on, or he wanted to get... Well, I guess he didn't really see Ezra. He saw Kanan and Ahsoka. So it would make sense that he would want revenge on Ahsoka. You could have done something there. You could have done something in the novels. I mean, I'm thinking, I just reread Inquisitor Rise of the Red Blade, greatest book of all time. You should go read it if you haven't. I don't think he's even mentioned in that.
No.
Like, the fifth brother gets mentioned. But yeah, you could have had him in Kenobi. You could have... There's so many possibilities where you could have made this character less of a loser, and you didn't. But I guess at the end of the day, it is Star Wars, so, you know, nobody might still be alive. Maybe we'll get it.
Exactly.
My number one, but we saw the body. We saw it split in two, and we went, oh, Snoke. Yeah, had to put Snoke on here. Potential to be a great addition to the galaxy, but his story was completely fumbled at the finish line. There's no two ways about it. When you watch The Force Awakens, you get this mysterious leader who makes you wonder, okay, how did he get into power? How did he draw in Han and Leia's son? Like, we're asking these questions. TLJ, he's used to advance Kylo's story. Which, I mean, works, not necessarily works how I think it could have worked. I think that you could have told more with him, but he worked as the plot point that he needed to be in that movie and was brought to an end, and would have been left better off, you know, left alone after that. But then we get Pickle Jar Snoke's in Rise of Skywalker, and it's not great. And when you think about in the story and you're watching these films, there's not really a feel that Snoke is really driving the First Order forward in the way that Palpatine drove the Empire forward. Snoke is completely focused on ending the Jedi, and not only is he incapable of that, I'd argue like he is part of the reason why the Force is awoken within Rey. Like, his decisions to turn Kylo to the dark, to do those things, had these consequences that were the exact opposite of what he was trying to do. So he's ineffective at accomplishing his goals. And he's different from Savage. Like, Savage is not just going after power, but he is a blunt force instrument. Snoke is purely like going after power, and in the same way that makes him uninteresting. Like, you don't really care about his mission, you know? You think about great villains like Thanos. You understand his mission, and you understand, even though you disagree with it, the perspective that he has, you can look at and go, okay, like I could understand how somebody could end up there. I don't want to end up there. Like, he's a warning symbol, but I can understand that. Even looking at the Joker in The Dark Knight, for as unhinged as he is, you can go like, I could see how somebody could look around the world that we live in and come up with ideas about how things do or don't work in that same kind of fashion. Snoke is just there for the power, and that's not very interesting. So he doesn't really draw me to the screen. He doesn't really add anything to our understanding of the dark side. I just overall, I think he's a really ineffective character. And when you look at the trilogy as a whole, the sequel trilogy as a whole, he clearly just like became a placeholder for Palpatine. In Force Awakens, they didn't really know what to do with him other than have him be big and intimidating. And in TLJ, they didn't flesh out a story. And so in Tross, they really just dropped the ball on developing him in any way, shape, or form. And even the tidbits we've gotten outside of the movies, you know, we got him in the Kylo comic. It's like, okay, he's in this garden and he's got like a flowery hat on. And it's like, okay, what the hell is this about? Like, what is this version of Snoke? I want to know more about this. And they're like, nah, we're just not going to tell you. So Snoke, like all of your theories about him, just kind of sucks.
Yeah, I am hopeful, optimistic that we might potentially get some more storytelling with around him in the future, now that particularly, you know, with the Mando stories and like that whole constellation is kind of pushing us into that Return of the Jedi, Force Awakens middle period, and we're getting some of that early First Order seeding. I think there's a lot of potential there. You know, if we were in the book realm, you know, given what he did with Shadow of the Sith, I think Adam Christopher would be like the guy to tell a really good Snoke story. If, you know, if Lucasfilm was willing to give it to anybody to do that. So I think there is a lot that can still be done with him to at least give him, like, you know, going backwards, because obviously in terms of what we see him in the sequel trilogy, like what we have is what we have. You can't really do much to kind of fill in like the in-between movies or anything like that. At least maybe like going backwards in terms of the rise of the First Order and like how does he come to kind of take over these, you know, imperial remnants that kind of go out into the unknowns and all that. I think there's a lot of potential there to do some stuff with him and make interesting. And so I'm really hopeful that they do that.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely could set stuff up with, like, the Imperial Remnant movie that Filoni's going to be doing that's supposed to, you know, more or less end the Mandoverse. Maybe you have some clues there, but I feel like they are more focused on getting to clone Palpatine than the role that Snoke played in getting to clone Palpatine. Like, I just right. don't think they're very interested in telling Snoke's story, because I love the sequel trilogy. Don't get me wrong. Like, to different extents, I love all of the movies, but he's kind of one of those glaring warts on the sequel trilogy where you just go, they really didn't have a plan, at least for what was going to happen with the villains, you know, like other than Kylo, which according to Adam Driver, even that changed. But other than focusing on Kylo, like they didn't know what to do with Hux. They didn't really know they had no clue what to do with Phasma. Like Delilah S. Dawson is the one that made Phasma an interesting character. Like they had no idea what to do with any of the villains. And so they were flying by the seat of their pants would be a compliment in that regard. And I know I sound really harsh, but I think if you just look at the movies and how characters like Rey and Finn and Poe were developed, how, I mean, even side characters, you know, BB-8 gets character development across the movies, I think. And your big bad villains, you just don't do anything interesting with other than Kylo, which, while yes, he's on the dark side, I don't think he is intended to be seen as a villain. Like, he's the character you feel empathy for in the same way that you do with Darth Vader, you know, of like, there's a good person inside of him. We didn't have a Palpatine of the sequel trilogy until Palpatine became the Palpatine of the sequel trilogy. And I think Snoke was supposed to be that and just didn't hit the mark. So, all right, let's move into our best, because I'm really excited for you to hear what's on my list, because I think I'm going to shock you
with
my picks. But I'm going to let you go first with your number two.
All right, my number two best. This is my light side or pick. And I had a hard time with this one because there are two characters that I kind of went back and forth on. I mean, I originally had one and then another one crept up and I was like, I don't know. And even in this moment, I'm not like 100% confident, you know, that I'm going the right way. But I think I'm going to stick with my original pick here, even though my other pick is very compelling and might even be on your list for all I know. So I guess we'll see. Maybe we'll end up talking about them. But I'm going to pick for my number two best is I'm going to pick, this is a Jedi. I think a Jedi who really just in their ethos and their approach, I think really just embody what it means to both be a Jedi, like in the most like sort of ideal highest sense, and what it means to be sort of a servant of the light. And yes, I am referring, friends, to Celandra Sho.
That is a solid freaking pick right there.
Yes. I think the idea of always the shield, I think, is one of the more profound statements of what it means both to be a Jedi and to serve the light that we've gotten, you know, in the last couple of years. I think that literal, I guess you could say weapon, although it's not quite a weapon because it's not an offensive weapon, but like that part of her, like that tool, that instrument that she uses as being a literal embodiment of this idea of like, you know, knowledge and defense, like that element, never attack. And like, it's not that she doesn't attack. She still has a lightsaber and she's still willing to use it when she needs to. But that idea that like, she prefers to lead with the shield and that she wants, you know, the shield to be this embodiment of how she imagines herself of protecting other people instead of, you know, being on the offense and attacking other people, I think is just an incredibly profound statement. And I think, you know, her relationship with her Padawan Rupert and the story in Tales of Light and Life that I thought was really good, of the shield being this kind of this like totem that gets passed down along this master and apprentice lineage. I really hope it shows up in phase three. I hope we get to see who has the shield now. I'm going with Celandra Sho.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm all about that knowledge and defense, never attack. And
yeah,
when I first heard the We Are the Shield philosophy that she has, I instantly was like, all right, cool. She is perfect. She can do no wrong. And we will stand her forever, because that is what the Jedi should be. And even if the shield doesn't come back, which I hope it does, you can see the contrast between somebody like Celandra and a character like Stellan or Elzar. Like, I'm not saying that they are bad, but or that they're not great characters, but that they are leading by fighting. You know, that's kind of what we're seeing happen with the Jedi, is that they're like, okay, we have to fight. Whereas Celandra was very much, we have to defend, and she found other ways. And yeah, I mean, she definitely had to fight at times, but that wasn't what she led with. And that's kind of what the Jedi are starting to lead with, in particularly in phase three. Like, they kind of get pushed to the brink in phase one. And then, you know, now they're having to make decisions, and they're starting to make decisions at the end of a lightsaber, which is something that Celandra was very intentional about avoiding. And it's great to me, because when we look towards future Force users and what they become, we can see that thread was never fully lost, which is why we can always continue, even with their flaws, to look at the Jedi as heroes, because I think underneath everything, there was always that idea. She just really embodied it in a very practical and real sense. And the execution of her character in the story is just really good. Like, they don't oversaturate it. There's clear parallels to Captain America, you know, with his shield, but it's not overdone. It's not, you know, a wink to the turn and wink to the camera. But there's definitely some homage there to Cap and the way that he leads and fights. And yeah, man, I didn't even think about Solandra, because unfortunately she didn't get a lot of time in the books, or in the Battle of Jedha even. But I definitely would love to see that shield make its way back around, or get pulled out of storage wherever it is in phase three. We've got a couple more books for that opportunity to happen, so we'll have to see. All right, are you ready, man? Because I'm about to blow your socks off with my pick.
Okay, I'm excited.
Okay. I don't think the pick itself is going to shock you.
All right.
But in my number two spot, to remind you, this is me talking about something Star Wars. And this is in my number two spot, Ahsoka Tano.
All right. Okay, I am a little surprised that she's not the number one, but I did think she was going to be in your best, so.
Yep, was going to be in the best. It'll make more sense when I reveal my number one, but I set my parameters before I picked my characters. And so I said, I have to stick with these things. And when I compared it to who my number one is, she fell short in some categories. And that said, though, like, the more and more Star Wars stories that are told, the more Star Wars evolves, the more and more important she becomes. So when you're talking about her effectiveness in the story, her story is becoming more and more effective as time goes on, because she's given more and more opportunities to be a part of the story. And when you just look at her ability to adapt to challenging situations and make difficult decisions and overcome everything that is placed in front of her in one way or another, most of the time in creative and inspiring ways that we wouldn't have expected, be it walking away from the Jedi Order or the end of Ahsoka season one, where she's, you know, we're right where we belong. The events of Shadow Warrior, even of choosing life. It really underscores her prowess in the Force. Like, it's all through the Force and with the strength of the Force that she's able to make those decisions. And so that really adds a lot to her credit. She adds a ton of depth to Anakin's character, being his apprentice, which, again, when you're looking at does the character do what it's supposed to do in the story, I think it's something at the start of her story that she was supposed to be doing. But she also provides insight to the complexities of the Jedi Order and the consequences of war. I mean, getting to see live action young Ahsoka fighting in a war in Shadow Warrior, just like, you, it's one thing when you see it in animation because you're used to seeing kids in kind of adult situations in animation. When you see it in live action, it's like, man, they really did have children fighting in this war.
Yeah.
And so she embodies those themes. And really, when it comes down to Ahsoka, like, the themes that she embodies are the biggest things for me. What she has to say about the struggle between light and dark, the importance of personal choice, the complexities of the Jedi Order, like, all of that is really powerful. When she walks away from the Jedi Order because of the flaws within the system, like, it really exposes it to the audience, and it really challenges us to question the institutions that we're a part of in a very healthy way, mind you. Like, she questions these traditional notions of the Force and morality and finding one's individual path in a world that is becoming more and more morally ambiguous. And how do you stick with what is right and that you know is right when how that looks is changing right in front of you? You know, when the foundations that you once had are no longer true. And she never loses her way in that process. She never loses her real sense of self. She never loses what she truly believes in, even as things get messier and messier. And so that, and then the way that she even grows beyond the Jedi Order, I think is something that's really important, because like Luke says in The Last Jedi, like, the Jedi don't own the Force. Like, the Force is going to keep going without the Jedi. And so the way that she develops her own philosophy and then implements that philosophy and really lives and almost dies based on how she implements those philosophies, I think is something that is really, really powerful. She is not caught in this dogma. And that's something that, like, thinking about an Obi-Wan, he does get caught in the dogma of the Jedi Order, and that's his greatest flaw. Ahsoka doesn't get caught in that dogma and finds her way out of it and is able to, in my opinion, become the ideal of what a Jedi should be. So, surprising nobody that Ahsoka is on my list, but I'm sure I shocked a few people that she wasn't number one, because some people just looked at the title of the episode and were like, well, Brandon's putting Ahsoka at number one again. Like, he would put her at number one on, like, best starships in the galaxy. But I really do think she belongs on this list because, again, of just the depth. When you look at every aspect of her character, the depth that she has is extremely compelling.
Yeah, I totally agree. She absolutely deserves to be on the list. I mean, I have sort of, you know, personally, I sort of have a handful of kind of sacred Jedi moments of like these are things that characters do or that they say that I think really kind of.
She is not caught in this dogma. And that's something that, like, thinking about an Obi-Wan, he does get caught in the dogma of the Jedi Order, and that's his greatest flaw. Ahsoka doesn't get caught in that dogma and finds her way out of it and is able to, in my opinion, become the ideal of what a Jedi should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's an amazing moment. Like, and she has so many of those, like, that one didn't even cross my mind as I was writing this list. Like, that's how many of those moments that she has throughout the story, you know? It's, and she became the literal embodiment of the light side, you know, through the life force of the daughter being poured into her. And then even thinking about the end of season 7 of Clone Wars and how she just stands there in her grief.
Yeah.
Looking at all those, like, those are clones' graves they've dug. You know, mm-hmm. You see Rex putting up the shovel. And to think about the fact that just a few hours earlier, maybe a few days, depending on you know, the time gap or whatever, but a relatively recent time period before, she was saying, I'm not going to be the one to kill them, and they died anyways. You know, she couldn't do anything to prevent it, and she's standing there. That's one of the first times we really see a Star Wars character just sit in their grief, you know? Like, we saw it in Rebels, but, like, chronologically, we don't see a lot of characters do that, you know? Like, Anakin becomes Vader because of his grief. He doesn't sit in it. Like, he becomes imprisoned by it, but he doesn't just sit with it. And that was a really powerful moment. I think if you are a Jedi in Star Wars, you if you're a Force user, rather, you have to be able to do that in order to have a healthy relationship with the Force. You know, I think that even when we look at our own lives, to be really in touch with our emotions and with the more spiritual side of our world, whatever you believe in, like, you have to be able to sit in your emotion, but then not get trapped in your emotion. And so when you contrast her and Anakin, like, that's another really powerful aspect of her character.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree.
All right. So who do you have as your number one?
All right. So my number one, again, to balance out the list, is the Darksider. I went with the character who I think in Star Wars really embodies, like, you know, in both, like, the kind of letter of what the Darkside means, and then even sort of revealing some of the morals of Star Wars about what it says about the nature of the dark side. I went with, who else? One Darth Sidious.
That's a good one. Good pull.
And,
good pull.
And yeah, I mean, there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, one is, of course, everything that, you know, he does over the course of the prequels in terms of, you know, he fulfills this 1,000-year plan of the Sith to both return and have revenge on the Jedi. He is able to, you know, we of course talk about Palpatine as sort of the master manipulator and everything that he does to kind of move things in his direction. But he also sort of has the benefit from his point of view of kind of inheriting this context of, on the one hand, a Senate that had become very corrupt and disconnected from, you know, ordinary people. Like his whole little shtick in Phantom Menace when he's talking to Amidala and is talking about, like, there's no interest in the common good, they're greedy squabbling delegates. That's kind of setting all that, the stage for what he kind of inherits and is able to use. So he's got the sort of corrupted Senate on the one hand, and then he's also got this sort of complacent Jedi order on the other that has really kind of set in their ways and doesn't really know how to adapt to change. And so he's able to use both of those to ultimately get his way and to ultimately, you know, take complete control of the galaxy and to turn the Republic into an empire and to destroy the Jedi. And, you know, there's that element to him, the element of him, you know, always being in the shadows and, you know, working through these public faces, whether it's like the Trade Federation, whether it's Dooku and the Separatists, but always kind of being in the background, pulling the strings. And then, of course, you know, this topic being Force users, you know, from his ability to kind of push the bounds, the extremes of what the Force can do in terms of his ultimate resurrection and cheating death, I think is also part of why I picked him there. And I think, like, I think there's a lot of, in terms of, I think there's a lot of symbolism and thematic work that is happening with Palpatine's return. One of the reasons why, you know, we talked about already, we've already touched a little bit on Palpatine's return in this episode because we were talking about Snoke and stuff. Why it works for me in The Rise of Skywalker is, like, you know, Yoda, of course, in, you know, Phantom Menace, talks about how fear is the path to the dark side. You know, fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, etc. And we see that manifest in Anakin and in other characters. But you always see sort of Palpatine there. You know, he's there in the prequels and there in the original trilogy. And he's this kind of master of the dark side. And, you know, you look at him and you ask, okay, well, if fear is the path to the dark side, what does Palpatine fear? It's not very obvious, you know, in the storytelling that we get. But then when you get him in The Rise of Skywalker, without saying it overtly, the movie answers the question, right? Like he becomes, you know, his master. He becomes Darth Plagueis. He is the man who gets so powerful that the only thing he's afraid of is losing his power. And he becomes so obsessed with that and overcome with that fear of losing his power that he is willing to dabble in these unnatural means and to extend his life, even if that means that he is essentially this corpse on this giant crane. It is a worthy trade-off to him. And so, you know, he is embodies that aspect of the dark side, of, you know, the morals and the warnings against the dark side, the inability to let go and move on. You know, as once I fell, so falls the last Skywalker. Like, he's still, it's been 30 years, he's still stewing about it. You know, he so pettily still wants that revenge for what happened to him. And so I think for all of those reasons, he is my pick for the embodiment, the very ethos of the dark side.
Yeah, I mean, a great character. I always think about the fact that he sat in front of the greatest Jedi masters of the generation, of generations when you consider Yoda. But you got Yoda, you've got Mace Windu, Ki-Adi Mundu, the whole Jedi Council just chilling there in his office, and they have no clue.
Yeah.
No clue. Like, the power that has to take is immense. And the skill, even more importantly than the power, like, is terrifying, you know? It's, you know, when you marry somebody and they become a different person, it's like you were this other person this whole time we were dating and together, and you just hid this darker side of yourself. And when it comes out, it comes out in full force. Like, I don't, it's scary and terrifying to think about. Like, it's not a pleasant thing to consider that what he's able to do. And I think that makes him like absolutely the embodiment of the dark side. And you said, you know, if he fears losing his power, you know, I think he also fears death. Like he says, you know, I've died before, but I don't believe him. Like, I mean, I know, yes, he's technically died before and it's kind of a meta thing, but I don't think he's saying that nonchalantly, you know. He's
no.
playing to Kylo's emotions. The man fears death. And especially when you look in a galaxy where you have the Yodas and you have these characters, you know, Wookiees, and that can live hundreds of years or centuries or however the hell old Maz Kanata is, because she's run the watering hole for 1,000 years. Who knows what else has gone on beyond those 1,000 years. So you've got these people that can live what seems like forever to a human that's living 70, 80, 100 years, maybe. It's way, way different. And so I think more than any of the other movies, Tross visually does a great job of showing the cost that he's willing to pay to hold on to that life, to extend that life. Like, I think the prequels is a testament to his skill and adeptness as a Force user. The original trilogy is, you know, him at his peak, and the sequels, you know, obviously Rise of Skywalker in particular, is really about the lengths that he is willing to go to cling to life and to manipulate the dark side to use it towards his own ends. And it turns out he's really freaking good at it, which is even more terrifying. So absolutely wonderful pick. Wonderful pick there. You got any idea who might be my number one?
There's one name that's coming to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's see. Let's see if it's who I'm thinking of.
Well, you picked the embodiment of the dark as your number one. I'm picking the embodiment of the light as my number one. I'm picking the OG, Mr. Luke Skywalker.
Oh, okay. Not who I was thinking, but another good pick.
I think you can look at anything that he does, whether it's destroying the Death Star, facing Darth Vader, redeeming Vader. Like, he rises to the occasion. He overcomes challenges. He fulfills his destiny on every step of his journey. Even when he fails in The Last Jedi, he is able to rise back up and find meaning in that failure. And that is really, really powerful. So in terms of, is he able to accomplish his goals and do what he is trying to do? Yes. Is he effective in the story? Absolutely. Like, he is a tool within the Star Wars story to tell about hope, to tell about resilience. And when you're looking particularly at the Force, to tell about the transformative power of the Force. Like, he is why I don't like this conversation about who's the most powerful. Because, if you want to argue, Luke probably is the most powerful, but he's the most powerful and he doesn't do it for power. He wins by throwing away his lightsaber. He wins by meditating. Like, if that doesn't embody the themes of Star Wars, I don't know what does, you know? Like, his commitment to the light side of the Force when facing these challenges that he faces throughout his stories, they don't just embody the themes, they are the themes. Like, he is the theme of Star Wars in living, breathing color, you know? Like, that's... And he's relatable really, like, Ahsoka is more relatable for me personally, but I think if you're just talking general relatability, Luke is the most relatable character in Star Wars, because we've all looked off into the sunset. We've all wanted to reach our full potential. We've all wanted to be able to do what Luke Skywalker is able to do. You know, his connection with the Force is just unlike any other Jedi that we've seen. His complete and utter faith in it from the get. You know, when we see him on the Millennium Falcon training and he's questioning Han and like, you don't believe in the Force? It's like, dude, you just learned about the Force like 30 minutes ago. But he just completely believes in it and trusts in it and has faith in it from the get. And that's what is required to do things like blowing up the Death Star. That is what is required to stand in front of your top pick, Darth Sidious, and be willing to die for what you believe in. And in the end, he does die for what he believes in. If nothing else, if you took away everything else that Luke does, his Force projection alone shows that he is the most skilled Force user in the franchise. Period. End of discussion. There is nothing that any other character does that shows more prowess and ability with the Force than Luke projecting himself. And they set it up perfectly in the story, and I will not hear any discussions otherwise. Like, they literally set it up earlier in the story, and then later it costs him his life. And it's a price that he not only is willing to pay in that moment, but always has been willing to pay. And when we think about, you know, the conversation we had about Salandra's show earlier in the show, and how she is, you know, the embodiment of the light because of, you know, leading with the shield. Luke himself is the shield.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing. Salandra has a shield. Luke is the shield. Yes. And so, in my opinion, like, that's why he is above Ahsoka in this particular list. Like, obviously, Ahsoka is still my favorite, and he would be my second favorite. If we were making that list, I would flip it. But when you're looking at, again, the parameters that I set were, are they effective at accomplishing their goals? Are they effective as part of the story? Do they convey the themes of Star Wars? Do they draw you to the screen? And are they adept in their relationship with the Force? Not their power, their relationship with it. Luke checks, like, he writes every box. He builds every box. Like, he is all of those boxes. And, I mean, I think you could argue, you know, out of maybe Palpatine or Luke, which one is more proficient as a Force user. But I think it really does come down to those two. Yours on the dark and mine on the light side are the goats.
Yeah, I think Luke is an excellent pick. I mean, again, going back to what I was talking about that sort of like the sacred Jedi moments. I mean, Luke gets us so many of them for me, whether it is Return of the Jedi, throwing away the saber, Battlefront 2, why did you help me? Because you asked. Last Jedi on Crait. You know, like, he has those moments. And, you know, you were talking about some of his like setbacks and failures. I think that is an important part of the story too, because I think one, and this is like, this is the thing that Yoda tries to, you know, tell him in that scene at the tree in The Last Jedi, of like, you know, being on the light side or, you know, falling light doesn't mean that you are 100% perfect every time and that you don't ever make a mistake. It's about, you know, stumbling and then you get back on the path. And of course, Luke has a lot of those, you know, the failure in the cave, his lack of belief in the Force when it comes to lifting the X-Wing out of the swamp. His decision to cut the training short and go to Cloud City. And then he gets, you know, the shattering revelation that his dad is not who he thought he was. But then his, you know, despite all of that, still staying on the path, and then, you know, coming close to coming off the path at the end of Return of the Jedi, when he gets very close to killing Vader, and then he has the moment where he sees the robot hand, and he's like, oh, I gotta step back, like, I'm not going in a good place here. And then, of course, even, you know, going to the sequels, where he has the failure with Ben, and the destruction of the Jedi Order, and he spends a more protracted time kind of stewing in his failure and his loss and really kind of cutting himself off from the galaxy and just sort of feeling like, you know, he can't, you know, there's nothing positive he can contribute. And I mean, like, I think, I mean, this is something that's been, of course, talked about. It's not a new insight, but like, that's what I think so many people, like a lot of people who are critical of The Last Jedi, or at least Luke's version, I think get wrong, because they're, you know, they look at him and like, well, like the First Order is out there and Kylo Ren is out there and, you know, Leia's fighting the Resistance and like, he's just like, doesn't care and is just, you know, like whatever, sitting on the side. Like, it's like, no, he thinks he's doing the best thing for everybody. Like, he thinks that by pulling himself out of the situation that, you know, if he inserts himself, he's only going to make things worse. That's why he's there. It's not that he doesn't care, but he just has, in the same way that, like, him really caring about Han and Leia is the thing that gets him to go to Cloud City, you know, and face Vader before he's really trained. Like, he's still going from that mentality of, like, I'm doing this because I care for my friends, but that leading him, you know, maybe a little bit astray, even though it's, again, like kind of good intentions, but, you know, where he ultimately goes is not the best. But then, like, even from that kind of low point for him to still come back from that and have the conversation with Yoda and, you know, like, remember that, like, the greatest teacher failure is, and that he still has something to offer the galaxy, and, you know, that's what he does on Krait in terms of giving the Resistance this moment to escape and, you know, survive and fight another day and then become that legend. You know, when we see the kids on Canto Bight and they're, you know, they have little action figures and they're kind of reenacting the story. I think he's a deserved pick for just one of the absolute embodiments of the light and the Jedi.
And I think when you consider that moment, or his position rather, in The Last Jedi, where we see him at the start, where he has pulled himself away, like, he is doing the opposite of what he did when he rushed off to Dagobah. You know, like, yeah, he saw how that pushed him to the dark, you know, and how arrogant he became at the beginning of Return of the Jedi. And he reflected on that and saw himself in that brief moment with Ben, even if it was a fleeting shadow, saw that that potential is still there. So I'm going to make the opposite decision that I made before, and I'm going to remove myself. That, again, going to being the shield, like, it's not about, the Force is not about a power that you have.
Yeah.
It's about a connection with every living thing. And he cut himself off from that connection in order for what he, you know, what he believed at the time, in order for everything else to survive. You know, like, I don't think he would have been okay if the First Order won and he would have just been there chilling like, oh man, Leia's dead. Like, I think he had complete and utter faith that Leia was going to be able to do this, that the next generation of heroes would rise up, which, of course, they did. And even in the Rise of Skywalker novelization, like, when he's one with the Force, we hear him talking to Leia, saying, you know, it's time for you to move on and let this next generation take the mantle. And that's something that he had to learn. And you know, when you look at the lessons that he learns, he never learns them the easy way. Like, but that's the story of a lot of us, you know? And I think that's part of what his character, how his character inspires us. When I look at the three most, if this was the three most inspiring Force users, you're looking at Luke, Ahsoka, and Obi-Wan, in my opinion. And what did all of them do? They failed miserably. They faced down the dark side and never once wavered and went towards it. That is, yeah, is really powerful. And Luke has more of that, I think, than we see in a lot of other characters. So I love me some Luke Skywalker. You guys know that. I'm sure nobody expected me to not have Ahsoka on the list. I'm sure nobody is shocked to see me have Luke on the list. But maybe the order kind of threw you for a little bit of a loop. So who did you think I had as my number one? Because you said you had an idea, and now I'm curious.
I had an idea, and probably I thought of this name because this was my bubble pick for best. This is the one that I was fighting with Salandra, and that was Kanan Jarrus.
Ah, that would have been a good one. When you're talking about embodiments of the light side of the Force, yeah. I think when you compare him to Luke and Ahsoka, though, he just doesn't have the breadth of work, you know? As a Force user, he has so much time away from the Force, and we have such just a sliver of time with him, where the other two, I think, cover a longer span of the Star Wars story, and that was something that I considered, but definitely right. An honorable mention for Kanan Jarrus. So let us know who is on your list. Like, who are your best and butts Force users in the Star Wars galaxy? Of course, you can stay in touch with us. Old school email, clashingsabersnetwork@gmail.com, or on any of our socials, at Clashing Sabers. Again, make sure you're subscribed so that you're getting all of our stuff. Make sure you go over and follow us. I'm putting out videos daily over on Instagram and TikTok, and posting conversations over on our Facebook group, Star Wars Clashing Sabers. So you can definitely check out everybody there, find all of our other shows, all of our other co-hosts. You can start fights with Drew in the Facebook group. It's a great time. So, Devor, if they want to find you, where can they find you specifically?
All right. If you want to follow me online, you can follow me on X, at A Larger View Pod. You can also go listen to me over on Space Swifties, a Star Wars and Taylor Swift podcast that I host with my wife, the one and only Meg Dowell.
I was talking with a friend of mine at work today. I had Taylor Swift playing. And he was like, really? You like Taylor Swift too? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I just wouldn't have put together like Star Wars and Taylor Swift. And I was like, oh no, it's a whole thing.
Yes,
there's a huge crossover of those two fandoms. And he just kind of like looked at me like I was crazy. I was like, you just really don't understand. So I wonder if on Taylor's new album, she's going to have a track entitled Batch 8.
Hi ho.
Get the new Taylor Swift album, everybody. What is it, April 18th?
19th?
19th? Okay. She could have gone with 13. That would have made it a lot easier for everybody to remember.
Yes.
Drop the ball there, Taylor. Come on now. You're better than that.
All Clashing Sabers productions are the intellectual property of the Clashing Sabers Network and ClashingSabers.net. All licensed sounds and images are the property of their respective copyright holders and are used for informational and educational purposes only. For more information on our nonprofit or to nominate a teacher, go to ClashingSabers.net. For questions or inquiries, please email us at ClashingSabersNetwork@gmail.com.
You're just going to walk away?